I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. This week, a first for the high-end retailer Neiman Marcus. The company itself is being bought, and the $5.1 billion price tag outstrips even the priciest items in the company's annual Christmas catalog. Perhaps you recall the Bell helicopter with its Italian leather seats and rosewood interior that listed for close to $7 million, or the four-lane basement bowling alley. The point is this. Neiman Marcus is clearly doing very well in what most people would agree is a pretty uncertain economy. And at the same time, Kmart and Sears had to link up to save themselves, and even Macy's and Filene's cut a deal to end the pain of their competition. So what does all this tell us about the state of America's economy? If the retailers on Rodeo Drive are doing well while the department stores in the mall are not, is that a sign of trouble, or is it a signpost to better times? Is this another indication that the rich are indeed getting richer while everyone else is looking for parking at Walmart? Give us a call. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And we're starting today with the Chief Financial Officer at Neiman Marcus. Jim Skinner is joining us on the line from Dallas. Jim, it's good of you to join us.
Thank you. Glad to be with you, Dick.
Listen, at a time when retailers are having so much trouble, what's the secret? Neiman Marcus seems to be healthier than ever.
Well, I think one thing that we've tried to do very strongly is focus in on who our customer is, know who we are, and know who our customer is. We're not trying to be all things to all people, but focus in on what our customers want.
And who are your customers, and what do they want?
You know, our customers tend to be high demographic consumers. What they want is quality, uniqueness, and specialness.
And do they need a lot of money to come and shop at Neiman Marcus?
Well, you know, we have probably a wider range of price points than people think. But you can actually spend what you want to spend at Neiman Marcus. Now, it doesn't mean that we have it for everybody, but there are price points that more people would find acceptable in cosmetics and some of our other lines, probably more so than people think. But on the other hand, you can spend quite a bit of money with us.
I mean, I remember at Christmas time, it used to be fun to take a look at what was really expensive in the Neiman Marcus catalog as a way of joking about, you know, whoever could spend $30,000 on a little toy car for their kid to ride around on in the basement track. But When you're making that pitch, are you saying that you're trying to speak to more people in America, saying that they're, you know, more than just the millionaires can walk out of the store with a Neiman Marcus bag?
Well, I mean, who we're speaking to are people who appreciate quality, uniqueness, and I'm going to say it with a fashion bend to it. And for those people, you know, everybody in America probably has certain areas of their life that they tend to spike up that. It may be their car, it may be their stereo, it may be their computer. For us, it's people that have an interest in fashion and uniqueness.
And when you talk about knowing who you are, knowing who Neiman Marcus is, I'm wondering, here you are, you're the CFO, you're the money man, you're supposed to be sort of looking after that kind of detail. Are you also a part of knowing exactly what the store is, the feel of the shopping bag handle and all that sort of attention to detail?
Well, we have a lot of meetings. As you can imagine, we care about our customers a lot. We have about 100,000 customers that represent $1.2 billion of our sales. So you can imagine we know them very well.
So I'd say a first-name basis.
Right. Well, you know, what's interesting is our buyers here in Dallas, when they're over in Europe and Milan, they can actually think about a customer. And, you know, what other business, we're not a large business as retailers go, but it's a $3.5 billion business. But when they're over there looking at the runway, they can think about Mrs. Smith in Beverly Hills might want that outfit. There aren't very many companies that can understand their customer that well that the buyer over there can understand, actually visualize a particular customer. And that's kind of detail, whether it's that or looking at the bags or the artwork. As you may know, we actually have a curator, and all of our stores have, you know, art that we pick out either locally. Some of them become very well-known. Some of them, they weren't well-known when we bought them, but at the point that they are today, they're very well-known. So there's some Picassos and things that are very unique to us. Part of that is trying to give the experience. Our customers want to have great items, quality, uniqueness, but in an environment that's special.
It would seem to me, Jim, that 100,000 customer base that you described is the sort that, you know, any retailer would kill for in terms of that kind of loyalty. But for your company to grow and to succeed, you need to get bigger and beyond then. And I guess what I'm interested in knowing from you is, as you look at where you are now and where Neiman Marcus has been heading, are you saying that this is the kind of company strategy and idea that's going to become a larger part of American retailing, even if I don't have, you know, the sort of shopper's attitude where I don't need to look at the price tag?
Well, you know, I actually believe everybody, no matter what their wealth is, looks at price tags at certain parts of their life. And again, that's why I think people choose where they spend money. We do believe, if you look at the demographic growth over the next 10 years, you know, our core customers are roughly 50 years old, female. The 45 to 65-year-old group is one of the highest-growing groups. There's also the transfer of wealth that's well-documented out there. You know, it's a lot of the brokerage house, and those people are positioning this. The baby boomers' parents are all passing away and transferring, you know, unbelievably large amounts of money to people who are in their peak earning periods. That combination probably would say there are going to be additional people that demographically can afford to spend what they want to in some areas of their life. That doesn't mean that all of them will spend it on fashion.
I'm wondering if, Jim, you can just sort of stick around for a couple of moments while I bring another guest in.
Sure.
Robert Frank is joining us from a studio at Cornell University in Ithaca, New York, where he's a professor of economics and management. Robert, you may remember, wrote that 1999 book, Luxury Fever, Why Money Fails to Satisfy in an Era of Excess. Hello, Robert. It's good of you to be with us.
Good morning, Dick. Nice to be with you.
You're listening, as I am, to Jim's description of the Neiman Marcus shoppers. And it occurred to me that you've also got to be looking a little bit at demographics here and the aging of the baby boomers and where they want to go with their money. Is that the secret to growth in the luxury and retail market now?
I think they're a part of it, but I think more generally we've got to look at where the distribution of income gains are going to fall over the coming years. And there's nothing I've seen, Dick, to challenge the idea that the pattern that's unfolded since about 1972 or so is going to continue. What we saw is a breakpoint about then. Before 1970, the three decades after World War II, everybody up and down the line saw their incomes grow at about 3% a year. What changed after that was that virtually all the income growth has been occurring at the very top of the income ladder.
Right.
And so the technologies that are driving that, the kinds of new information that we have that puts us in contact with the best players in each market, I think that's all just really beginning to unfold. So I look for income growth to continue to be strong at the top of the income ladder, and that's what's really been driving this all along.
But are you saying, Bob, that that's a larger group of people now, or that's kind of a finite group of people who are simply gathering unto themselves more and more money?
Well, it's mostly the second, but there's also a little bit of an expansion in the group, too.
Which comes as a result of the 1990s, which comes from where? How do you track that back?
Well, it's really a process that's been going since long before the 1990s, and we've seen processes like it in earlier times, too. When the railroads were built, that meant the best producer in Ohio could suddenly make contact with markets all around the country. Now, with so much of the content of a good wrapped up in the ideas inside the good, it's almost free to ship it anywhere in the world. Mm-hmm. So much of the product is value-added in information. And so we can make the contribution in one spot, and then if you've got it, it's very cheap to copy it. You can send it over long distances. And so what used to be the local province of talented people here and there has now more and more become the province of one very talented player in a central location. Tax advice used to be a quintessentially local practitioner industry. You'd go and talk to your accountant, and the best ones had richer clients than the worst ones. But now, you know, there was a big dogfight who was going to write the most user-friendly, comprehensive tax software program. And once that was settled, really more and more people are coalescing around that.
Let's come back to shopping here for a minute, because I'm interested in your thoughts on a question that I asked Jim, and that is, how much of this growth in the luxury and retail market in this country is people who can almost shop there, but not quite, but really want to shop there, will go in and stretch themselves so they can have, as I said, the Neiman Marcus bag?
There's a lot of that. I think mostly the kind of financial pressure that we hear the middle class suffering under these days isn't because they're trying to buy Prada handbags. Mainly it's just trying to keep up with mortgage payments on a house that's beyond their reach, having to commute long distances and so on. But there is an element of that. The people at the top have earned more money. Naturally, they're spending more, and I think that sets a standard for people just below the top. The people in the middle generally don't try to imitate people directly at the top because they can't and really have no interest in it. But there's a cascade that we see. The top influence the people just below them. They spend more, and so people just below them spend more. And so now to give a gift on an important social occasion, you really have got to spend a lot more than you used to if you're somebody from the middle. And that's going to get some of us into Neiman Marcus looking for something special.
Jim Skinner, you count on that, I suppose.
Right, and there's really two sides. You've really got your core customers, who the ones who are going to be our 100,000 customers spending $1.2 billion. There's going to be people who do spike up. We see individuals, especially young professional females, who will spike up in either handbags or shoes. Then you've got things like cosmetics that are really some widely distributed cosmetics that we sell along with some of the department stores that people may literally go into our store just to walk out with a bag so they can carry out a Neiman Marcus bag. That's also fine. Some of those people who spike up or people in the future may be a core customer. Some of them won't be. Some will use it for just the extra special. And putting it in a bag or putting it in a box from Neiman Marcus adds to the cachet as a given.
Jim, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks. Jim Skinner is CFO of Neiman Marcus, joining us there on the line from Dallas. We'd like you to join us on the line. What do you think is driving America's love of luxury? How do you define luxury? Is it a brand? Is it a fancy shopping bag from a store that you wouldn't normally go in? Or is there another way of looking at it? And do you feel this pressure to somehow be a part of that market if, in fact, it's doing as well as it appears to be doing? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. The sale this week of the high-end luxury retail store Neiman Marcus for over $5 billion was a little bit of a bell in terms of trying to help us and you figure out where the economy is going. We'd like to have you join us on the program as we take a look at what it is that luxury tells us about the state of the economy in general. Robert Franks joining us from Cornell University, where he teaches economics and management. And I'm wondering, Bob, if I can ask you just to give us your sense of what does the robustness of the luxury market tell us about the state of the economy? Is it just a little slice at one end, or does it say something more about the state of this country?
I think the prosperity of the luxury retailers is really telling us that end of the market is where the income has been accumulating over the last years. The general rule in economics is people spend what they earn. Mm-hmm. We save some of it, but in America, not much. And if income gets spent, we have to look and see where the people are earning more income than before. And the trend over the last decades has been almost however we define the group. If you look at college graduates, it's the same. If you look at dentists, it's the same. And the trend is this. If you're at the bottom of the group, you're not doing too well. You're doing maybe even worse in absolute terms than you were 25 years ago. If you're in the middle, you've had some moderate income gains, but really not much. It's really the people in the top fifth of every group that have had the gains. And then if we look within that group, we see the same pattern there too. So it's the people at the very top of the top fifth who've gotten most of the gains within the top fifth.
And why isn't there some kind of trickle down, for example? If that top fifth is doing as well as you say, why isn't there a kind of, you know, it helping to float everybody else's boat at the same time spin-off?
Well, there is some of that, but I think what we see now is that there's even more of a trickle-up phenomenon going on than a trickle-down phenomenon. So if you look at what happens when somebody gets a big new pay increase who's already got a lot of money, where does that money go? At one time, it might have trickled down in the form of hiring a lot of extra servants, mm-hmm. or buying goods that were manufactured with manual labor, but
or expanding the factory, creating more jobs.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Cars that used car manufacturers that employed skilled and unskilled laborers to produce the kinds of things that people at the top with extra money might buy. What we're seeing more and more now is that people at the top are buying specialty items. whose demand actually increases the skewness in the income distribution that brought it about in the first place. So you go to cosmetic surgeons, you go to specialty designers, you go to a whole phalanx of people where the dollars you spend are going to be going primarily not to lower income people, but to the people who directed those new enterprises.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to hear from you on this topic. Let's hear from Pam Danziger. She's founder of Unity Marketing, joining us on the line from Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Pam, it's good to have you with us.
Nice to be with you today.
Your firm conducts research on the retail market with a specific look at the luxury retail market. Is that right?
Exactly. Yeah, and I just wrote a book that's out now in the bookstores called Let Them Eat Cake, Marketing Luxury to the Masses as Well as the Classes.
And is that exactly what's going on that the success of a place like Neiman Marcus is in convincing ordinary people that they too are welcome to a place like that? Because the money doesn't appear to be there, really.
Well, you know, it's very interesting, and this focus on Neiman Marcus has got us looking at what we call luxury goods and the acquiring of more material things. But what's really interesting, and this has been what I found over the course of all the research that I've done with the luxury consumers, and that's the top 25% of consumers based upon income, which starts at about $75,000 and above, that the number one place where luxury consumers get their greatest satisfaction and happiness comes from luxury experiences, not from acquiring more material goods.
What's a luxury experience?
Oh, a luxury experience would be things like travel. It would be things like dining out. It would be things like going to the spa and getting your nails done and a pedicure and massage. And cosmetic surgery and things like that. But it really is it's all about what we do. I mean, the luxury in life, and you know, people know this. Things aren't going to make, I mean, luxury consumers definitely know this. Things aren't going to make you happy. Where you get your happiness from is from the things you do, not from the things you own. And I think that it's a very interesting perspective, because the fact is people feel this way and view the world this way, yet they spend a tremendous amount of money acquiring more luxury goods.
Let's take a call from Madrid, New York. Mickey's joining us from there. Hi, Mickey.
Hi. What I'm wondering is, it kind of goes along with what this lady is saying. How do you feel that the huge accessibility of credit cards to everyone today may be affecting some of this? You know, someone may be offered a credit card with a $15,000 credit limit on it for the first time and think, I'm going to Neiman Marcus, when they might not necessarily be prepared to deal with a credit line of $10,000 because of their income and their budget.
Well, you know, because again, I'm studying the luxury consumers, and these are the people at the top 25% of U.S. households based upon income. And what we find is that they are very heavily invested in maintaining their quality of life, and that's what the luxury is for them. It's an enhanced quality of life. So they are not the ones who are likely to go out and spend beyond their abilities. They're much pay off that credit card when the bill comes due at the end of the month. I think that the problem, and I'm not an economist, so I'm going to defer in that question, but it seems to me that it's people at lower income levels that may be going a little bit too fast. It's not necessarily the luxury consumer.
What do you think, Bob? Is there some still keeping up with the Joneses going on here?
There is that. I think it's not well construed as trying to keep up with the Joneses, though, because that gives a kind of a negative spin to people's efforts to show off or put on airs. I think what we've seen is that as the people at the top have been building bigger houses, that changes the social climate in the group where they are in ways that others who are near them have to respond to. I mean, you and I don't have any aspiration to copy Bill Gates's mansion. That's not something we could do or would want to do. We don't envy him. We don't feel bad about it. But there are people who are just below the very top who, when the mansions get bigger at the top, feel they have to respond in some way. Maybe it's now the custom to have your daughter's wedding reception in the home instead mm-hmm. of in a rented space. So they build bigger, and then people below them build bigger too. And it cascades down. Now the person in the middle, the median new house built in the U.S. in 2001 was about a third larger than it had been in 1980. So it went from 1,500 square feet to 2,100 square feet. And that's a big burden for the person in the middle to carry. It's not keeping up with the Joneses in any sense of trying to show off, but it's, you know, that's what you have to do if you want to send your kids to an average school. You have to buy the average price house. So they're burdened with debt to carry that kind of a mortgage, and then the credit cards do give them a way to escape a payment that they can't meet when a paycheck doesn't show up, a family member gets laid off, or there's a health problem. So I think the credit cards do play a role in getting people overextended.
And just to look at it from the other perspective then, Bob, if you were to drive through one of those neighborhoods and look at all those homes, would you be mistaken to say, you know, the country's doing pretty well. Look at all these really nice homes that ordinary middle and upper middle class people are living in.
They're bigger houses, and so, yes, it would look like we're prosperous, but at the same time, our savings are at an all-time low. We're borrowing at much greater rates than we ever did. Families are filing for bankruptcy
right.
at record rates now. The commute times are longer. I mean, people are working longer hours. There's a lot of financial stress there in the middle, and I think it's not because they're trying to buy fancy Neiman Marcus handbags. It's
right.
just because they're trying to send their kids to a decent school, and to do that now, you've got to spend a lot more on a house than you used to.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, where do you fit in this puzzle? Are you hearing yourself described? Or are you frustrated knowing that you are either in or out of this particular space? Let's go to Dallas, Texas. John's joining us on the line from there. John, thanks for calling.
Hey, thanks a lot.
What do you think?
I think that the reason we're moving more towards luxury goods is because normal consumer goods are of such poor quality. I mean, everything from a T-shirt to a house, if you're buying the standard off-the-shelf type of stuff, is just terrible.
So would you spend several hundred dollars on a Burberry raincoat so you didn't get one where the buttons would fall off? Is that part of what you're saying?
I think a lot of people do. It's not so much price as value. You could go to Walmart and buy a raincoat for, say, $10 or whatever, and you buy three of them over the course of a couple of years. Or you could go and find a better one for, say, twice the price or three times the price.
And do you find yourself doing this as well, John, saying, I'm not going to buy another one of those, you know, $99 DVD players. I'm going to get something that I know will last more than a couple of years?
Yeah, unfortunately. The gap between the consumer product and the luxury-type product is so huge that you can't do it all the time. But I'll give you an example. I just bought a barbecue grill. It cost me almost $1,000. And the reason I did it is because everything I was looking at in a more reasonable price range would last only a couple of seasons.
Now, Bob, Frank, this is perfect for you. You were writing about barbecue grills when you talked about the luxury fever, and you know what John's talking about.
Exactly. Yeah, I've become a clearinghouse for ads for barbecue grills. People send them to me all the time. There's $1 million one out there now.
Get out of here.
You've got to be kidding.
A gold-plated one, yeah. The reason they offer those, I don't think anyone ever buys these items that they put in the catalogs, but the fact that you know there's $1 million grill out there means that you can think of yourself as a value shopper if you buy the $30,000 model.
Yeah,
it's a context-shifting device that the marketers seem to have stumbled onto.
Well, you know, one of the interesting phenomena is, you know, I understand your frustration with the quality, but at the same time, the quality of manufactured goods, in fact, are going up and the prices are coming down. So what we find in the luxury market is not just, I mean, we're not just seeing middle-class people reaching up and to go to Neiman Marcus to buy stuff that is more expensive than they can afford, but we're also seeing luxury consumers who can afford to spend, you know, Neiman Marcus prices shopping at Target because they can get good quality, or going to Gap, or going to Banana Republic. I mean, the fact is that there's a trading down phenomenon going on with luxury consumers knowing where good value lies, knowing where they can find good quality pieces, and shopping there.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. John, just one more from you. What does that $1,000 grill do?
It's a smoker, but it's a very, very heavy gauge steel, and a smoker tends to rust out pretty easily.
Yep.
And you want one that's very heavy gauge steel. Most of the stuff that you could buy, let's say a Home Depot or a Sears or something like that, is such thin steel that it'll rust almost immediately.
And so at the end of that purchase, are you feeling like you spent more than you should have had to spend? Or are you saying, you know, this is just what I needed to do here.
I didn't want to spend that much money on a grill. But because everything else was of such poor quality, it's what I ended up having to do. I could have bought over the course. I mean, a smoker ought to last for a good long time.
Yeah.
Over the course of time, I expected to keep this thing, I would have had to buy three or four or six or God knows how many of the cheap smokers.
Well, we'll be here in a few years. Check in with us and let us know that it's still working. 1-800-423-8255. Bob Frank, one of the things that you have spoken about in the past is leather car seats, which I thought was rang a bell with me because I'm thinking, okay, when I was a kid, I didn't know anybody with leather car seats. But you walk through the school parking lot now, and you'll see a lot of that. And it used to be a mark of luxury. I'm wondering if it still is. Or, you know, does it mean that people have made more money so they can afford it? Does it mean simply that the price has come down? How do you make sense of something like that?
Well, Dick, I think luxury is always what stood out from the background. So it's a changing, it's a shifting target. As generally we all spend more money, the kinds of things that you need to have in order to stand out just get a little bit more elaborate. So in the 80s, you didn't see too many cars that had leather seats. There were some. The top models of Saab and BMW had leather seats, and then higher up the scale you'd find them. But the ordinary middle-class cars didn't have them. Now it's quite common, as you say, to see them in cars up and down the price line. And so if you buy a car with leather seats now, well, it's the same leather seats, but it's not that same special high-impact feel you get from sitting in a car with leather seats. It's come to be expected. So in that way, I think the bar just gets lifted over time.
And do we use that as a measure of wealth in the country or just that we, our taste changes?
Well, there's a lot of churning to this. I mean, I think it is true, as Pam Danziger said, that the quality levels in many products has been going up. But with the increase in quality level comes an increase in expectations. I had dinner with a law professor a few years ago, and he drove up in a Lexus. And the first thing he wanted to tell me when we sat down was he didn't know or care what any of his colleagues drove. He was very keen that I not think he had bought this car to show off. And I said, well, why had he bought it? Had he been driving? He'd been driving a Buick before that, and yeah, traded in. And he really liked the Lexus because it was the sound the doors make when you close them. It was just quality, and it was the fit and finish. He really liked the idea that you had to be careful not to start the car once it was already running. The engine was so quiet and vibration-free, that was a warning they put in the owner's manual. And so I asked him, how did he think people in 1930 would react to his Buick that he traded in if you could somehow ship that back in a time capsule and let them try it? And he seemed to recognize immediately that they would have been just as awestruck by the quality of his Buick, the sound that the door makes. You know, yeah, that's the sound we hear today as, well, it's a GM product. What'd you expect? The very same sound in 1930 would have sounded like quality. You know, the acceleration of that car would have been breathtaking, the cornering ability. Everything would have struck people as just a really special car. And so luxury is really not about showing off. It's about something that feels special, and that's all about context. It's just how is it compared to what we're used to.
Right.
And so as you get used to things that are of higher and higher quality, then an item of given quality loses its capacity to give you that jolt.
And Penn, do you agree with that?
Oh, definitely. I mean, I call it the phenomena of luxflation, that there's this kind of continual inflation of our luxury expectation. So in effect, I mean, luxury, you never can ultimately achieve luxury. I mean, ultimately, because as soon as you buy the Lexus and you start driving it and you notice the quietness of closing the door and the quietness of the engine and all that other stuff, I mean, after a couple of weeks, your Lexus isn't that special luxury car anymore. It's just your car, and there are French fries on the floor, and it's a little dusty.
We're going to come back and talk a little bit more about luxflation and where you fit in that. Just taking a look at the health in the luxury high end. Is that just a sort of looking at how the people on the other side of the tracks are doing well while nobody else is, or does it really have more to tell us about the way that we consume and the state of the country's economy? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And looking a little bit past the glitter of luxury this hour to what it means to all of us, Robert Frank is with us from Cornell. He's a professor of economics and management and author of a book, Luxury Fever, another one, What Price Moral High Ground. Pam Danziger is also with us. She is the founder of Unity Marketing and author of a book called Let Them Eat Cake, Marketing Luxury to the Masses as Well as the Classes. I'd like to hear where you are on this. We're going to go back to the phones. Lexington, Massachusetts, and Kaliani's with us. Hi there. Lexington. Hi. Kaliani, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, good. I hear you now. What are you thinking?
Well, a lot of different things. We have an old grill that I bought in 1995, and we are refurbishing it with parts from Home Depot, so I just wanted to throw that out there.
Because it fell apart. No, they do wear out. I get that. It's 10 years. Yeah.
And we're moving to a town that is far more expensive than the town we're living in now because of schools, and we're moving from a brand new house, of which we are the first owners, into an older, smaller house that needs a lot of work, and we're doing it willingly. So for me, the luxury there is having the better education.
Right. That's what Robert was saying earlier in the program.
Which I completely agree with him. What he said just before the break really connected for me, that it's a choice. And it's luxury is very much part of a context. Because for me, it's a luxury to be home with my children. So I'm choosing to do that and not work very many hours. On the other hand, it's a luxury to eat well. I'm a gourmet cook, so I do spend money on certain types of ingredients. But I may choose to be in a smaller house and to not have a better car because those things are not priorities for me. But the other thing that also occurs to me is when I was growing up, I grew up in India. Again, context plays a role here. To have a piano in the house is a tremendous luxury, to have a musical instrument in the house. And we do have a piano now, and I don't see it as a luxury because my children have a talent. And I feel like I owe it to them to provide them with this means to express their talent.
I guess what I'm wondering is, though, how easy is it to make those decisions to say no to the more classic elements of how we define a luxurious lifestyle? If you're okay with a car that's got a little bit of rust showing or a house that needs a lot of work, obviously that's, you're okay with that, but do you look over the fence and wonder if everyone else is okay with that?
You know what I think it is? I think it's a question of maturity and having your priorities right. As long as the roof over your head doesn't leak and you're safe in your home, I don't think you need extra bedrooms. The house we live in now is very large, and it's not even fully furnished because we chose not to spend that money. And I'll be very honest with you, we bought this large house because at the time we were kind of thinking that my husband would lose his job and we would have to move to California. And I felt like, well, I have to be able to parlay my current home into at least a shack in someone's backyard in Northern California. So I needed the power to buy a home on the West Coast. So we bought a larger home than we needed.
Kaliani, thanks for calling. Nice to hear your perspective on this. I want to go straight to Charleston, South Carolina. Joe's joining us on the line from there. Joe, does that match up with you? How are you looking at things?
Well, it's strange that you should be talking about this. Saturday evening, a couple of friends and I were talking about the very same thing. And we've noticed that our children, and of course, I'm 50 years old, and when I was growing up, we didn't have nearly as many of the play pretties, and you know, we didn't have all of the little doodads that our children have. Now they've grown up, and I think that there's a certain expectation as our society grows and the things that are available are there. You know,
Joe, but tell me something. Do you stretch yourself to give them all those things that they come to expect, whatever little doodads or toys they think should be a part of their youth?
I personally don't. I have one child, and I kind of raised her in the same mold that my parents raised me, a little more frugal. She is a teenager and she works. And
so financially, you're fine. You're not carrying debt or anything like that.
No, but the whole conversation Saturday evening started because of we noticed that with other people's children, and in particular, there was one child who had just graduated from high school, and they couldn't understand why they couldn't go out and get themselves the new car and start at the top. They have this expectation of entitlement.
Pam, that's the sort of luxflation that you're talking about, isn't it?
Well, you know, it really is, but it's very interesting that as people mature, they really do undergo predictable shifts in their perspective of material wealth and material goods, because when you reach the point of like 50, 55, 60, mm-hmm. it's like you've already done it. You've been there, done that. And material goods, again, you've learned that isn't going to be the answer or the solution to your problem, so you focus more on experiences. And in my book, we talk about a unique kind of consumer called the butterfly, who really is not motivated materialistically, does not want to acquire things for the sake of acquiring things, but has a much different perspective. Yet again, they
but is willing money. To spend $250 at the spa on a Friday afternoon, right?
I mean, yeah, they have the money, and they see no reason not to spend the money because they have the wealth and the means to purchase it. But again, it's not because it doesn't have or hold meaning to them. What is meaningful to them is donating money. If you look at people like Bill Gates or Oprah Winfrey, Ted Turner, all of those people, very rich, very affluent people, are actually turning their money they're giving it to causes to enable to make the world a better place when they leave it. And that's really the perspective of the butterflies. I mean, not that they have the wealth of those people, but they really do want to make the world a better place, and they know that by donating to charities, by giving it to the community, sharing that wealth.
Okay, but let's come down back to people who are trying to make sense of where they fit in what we're calling, or in our look this hour at luxury. And I'm thinking, for example, Bob, of people I work with will spend $3 or $4, maybe even $5 for a cup of coffee. Now, if my mother knew that, we were spending that much on coffee, she would be outraged. And that's, again, part of the shift, isn't it?
That's right. It would have seemed shocking to somebody 20 years ago to say how many people at what income levels were spending that much on a cup of coffee, not maybe once a day, but 2 or 3 times a day. And to cut back is often awkward. I mean, if your friends are going and you can't go, or you say, that's not for me, then you're not part of the group. So it's not even necessarily trying to show off that you're spending that on coffee. It's just everybody wants to be sociable. You want to eat at the same restaurants your colleagues and friends eat at. And if everybody else is moving up and you decide to be more prudent, well, there's a price to pay there too.
And still, that's not watching the whole level shift up necessarily.
That's right. You know, there are awkward decisions to make. The wine column in the Wall Street Journal had a very nice discussion a few years ago about what should I bring as a gift. I've been invited to a colleague's house for dinner. I know he likes wine. Mm-hmm. Give me some advice. And so they said, buy wine he's unlikely to have tried before. Very good advice. But then they said, plan on spending about $30. And that really caught my eye, because there's some wonderful wines still out there for under $10. The experts say they're better than the wines mm-hmm. drunk by the King of France 200 years ago. Why isn't a $10 wine good enough? And I think the concern is, if it's somebody who likes wine, you want the gift to reflect the fact that you think it's a special occasion, and special means it's got to stand out in some way. So ordinary isn't quite right for the occasion. So we're stuck. You can either risk being seen given a gift that might say you don't think it's a special occasion, or you spend $30.
Let's go to Boston for our next call. Margaret's joining us on the line from there. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, how are you?
Fine.
I wanted to just follow up on the comment that your guest just said about wanting to stand out. To me, this seems a very new phenomenon. I mean, my grandmother, who could probably have bought, 10 McMansions, would have been absolutely horrified at the idea of standing out.
How do you define standing out, though, Margaret, when you hear that?
Letting people, flaunting one's wealth,
right.
Conspicuous consumption.
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering, if my question is, you know, sort of like that old saying that if you go back two generations in a rich, respectable family, you'll find a robber baron. I'm just wondering if this sort of attitude toward really conspicuous consumption, instead of, you know, being on the board of the symphony or you know, being raised to feel that having money is a responsibility rather than a right. I'm wondering if that is a generational phenomenon. If the, you know, the sort of the nouveau riche have to go through and do their thing, and then they raise their children with a different attitude.
Yeah, as you describe it, Margaret, I'm wondering if, Robert, you can help us with this. Is there a graph that sort of goes up and goes down in terms of people's desire to want to show that they have wealth?
I don't think it's primarily wanting to show off. We all know people who do want to show off, so I'm not saying there's none of that. I think it's just mainly follow the money. The real change now is that people are buying things that seem incredibly lavish to us who have less money, and we don't allow for the fact that in their circle those things don't seem so lavish to them. I was a Peace Corps volunteer years ago in Nepal. If anybody in my village came and saw the house I live in, which is really just a professor's house in a modest neighborhood, they'd think I'd completely lost my senses. What would somebody need such a house for? And so I think for us to look up to the people at the top and say that they're shallow, that they've lost their bearings, there's no moral compass there, is to really miss sight of the fact that we're all very local creatures. We're just, you know, we do what people around us do. And in some circles where the incomes and wealth levels have just been exploding to such levels, it's become normal to live in houses like that. I don't think people in those circles see that to everyone else it looks so ostentatious.
And Pam, people's relationship with what it is they buy, I'm wondering if you see a shift there away from the way that we were always taught or told that we defined ourselves by what we wore and we defined ourselves by what we bought and what we drove and all that.
Well, yeah, we're seeing this shift toward experiences in the luxury market, and it isn't, I mean, it's going across the board. Now, some people do spend more money and spend more emphasize the material goods, and in fact it seems to be very age related, because right now the Gen Xer population are making inroads into the luxury market, and we're seeing more of them. Their incomes are rising. They're age 28 to 40 years old this year, so they're starting to acquire affluence, and what we see is they spend more money on material goods than the baby boomer generation, which is from 41 to 58 years, I think, this year.
Right.
They're spending more money. But I think what's going to happen, though, is the Gen Xers, as they get more maturity, they acquire more things, they're going to realize that isn't the answer, and, you know, where is another thing going to fit, because their closets are full and their basements is full of stuff.
Just buy a bigger house.
Well, no, yeah. But
I mean, I say it half in jest. I know that certainly some people roll their eyes because that is one solution to acquiring too much stuff. Let me just remind our listeners, I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection. To Augusta, Georgia for our next call. Joel is with us. Hi, Joel.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine, thanks.
I have several points. First of all, is for a lot of individuals such as myself, when we were younger and we were given credit, you know, we wanted to be sort of like James Bond and, you know, have a martini shaken, not stirred, and smoke the Cuban cigars or whatever. And when we got those credit card bills and started having to pay them off, that sort of self-corrected our desire for a lot of luxury goods. And the second point was there's a whole nother culture out there that's looking for bargains.
Mm-hmm.
You go to sites like fatwallet.com, and there's a very busy forum on there, people posting deals and coupons.
Well, that's partly what eBay is about, isn't it? I mean, a chance for people to do that. But let me come back, if I can, Joel, to this thing, this sort of self-correcting thing. In your view, does it work at most levels where people need to sort of screw up at one point in terms of how they spend or what they reach for in the way of luxury goods before they realize what's within and what's outside their grasp?
I think a lot of people do go through that. Not everybody, but I think a lot of people do go through that, where they maybe max out their credit or extend their credit to a point where it's sort of painful to pay back. especially when you're young and you're paying, you know, say 12 or 18% on a credit card, you know, your payments start stretching out over 5, 6, 7 years, and you end up, you know, realizing, wait a minute, that Cuban cigar wasn't quite worth it. Maybe I could have gotten by with a Tampa Nugget that night, you know, instead of a Havana.
Let me, if I can, Joel, take that point and turn to Robert Frank on looking back over time. I mean, has there always been this kind of oops self-correction that's a part of the way that we consume or aspire to consume things beyond our reach?
Sure. That's one of the things that we have in mind when we talk about growing up. Kids have a very hard time postponing gratification. Teenagers are a little bit better at it. When you're in your 20s, you're better still. But
parents, you know, have a terrible time.
For people at any age level, it's the thing now has a lot of allure relative to the thing later. So, you know, the sports car, you could have a good time today. The reduced standard of living retirement, well, that's still a few years away. So it takes discipline, and I think the older you get, the better you are at that, but we're still, all of us, struggling with it.
You and Pam have both said that the older we are, the better we get at it. Is there going to come a time, though, when even young people aren't necessarily as seduced by what's on the shelf or what's being advertised?
My instinct is no. I'm just judging from what I see with my sons growing up. I think it's just the nature of kids. They're very influenced by the external. I mean, they are much more influenced by their peer group, I think, than as you get older, you become more individual and more recognizing. I mean, understanding that Robert talks about this context, and I agree with him there, but I think kids are going to be, because they don't really know who they are yet, and that's part of, you know, am I a James Bond cigar smoking person, or am I a guy who likes to sit and watch football with a beer? You don't really know yet, so it's like you're trying to find yourself and find your identity, and you do achieve that as you get older. And again, that's where you kind of learn it's not about these things. It's about the family. It's about the relationships. It's about the things you do.
Pam, I want to thank you for being with us on the program today.
Thanks so much.
Pam Danziger, founder of Unity Marketing, and Robert Frank, thanks for your time. Nice to have you with us.
My pleasure, Dick.
Bob is a professor of economics and management at Cornell University. We talked earlier in the program with Jim Skinner, chief financial officer for Neiman Marcus. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.